Hey folks, before you listen to this week's episode about the world's worst restaurant with only the bloody winner of Bake Off, David Atherton, our second one, we're doing sort of a Pokemon with them. We've got to catch them all.
and eventually, if we get all 10 of them, we get Mary Berry.
Yeah. we want to remind you that this is the last episode going out before our live show, which is coming up on the... we're recording it on the 29th of February at 4:30pm at the Vault Festival in Waterloo in London. Tickets are available if you visit vaultfestival.com and search for Worst Foot Forward Live. And we have announced our guests that will be joining us. We've got three guests coming on board for the world's worst dinner party. They are Dr. Anna Porshaisky, Beck Hill, and Joel Morris, all previous guests of the show. If you're not sure about coming, you want to check them out, go listen to their previous episodes and then book a ticket because it's only a few days away now, and that episode will be going out next week if you don't make it along.
Yes, it will. And also, I'm going to do some do-it-yourself promotion as well. I'll level with you guys. We're recording this at the end of January, so I'm going to say it was lovely to see so many of you at Fablemaker last week.
And I'm delighted my play has won so many awards.
Yeah, and that personal recommendation from Dara O'Brien meant so much. But if you couldn't catch that in London, if you're not able to catch our show this weekend on February the 29th, tomorrow night, February the 25th, I am taking Fablemaker on tour to Luton, to a place called the Bear Club, which is, oh, it's such a cool venue. Yeah, it's a massive old jazz club. I'm doing a double header with a guy called Robin Morgan, who is a writer for the News Quiz, really, really great stand-up comedian. If you're kicking around tomorrow night, chuck a tenner our way, come and watch me and Robin do our shows, we'll make you laugh loads. What else are you going to do on a Tuesday?
I feel like that should be the marketing plan for all of your shows. Come along, we'll make you laugh loads.
Yeah, well, that's essentially the heart of our compact.
Yeah.
It'd be lovely to see you at that. It'd be lovely to see you at the live show. Any other business, Mr. McStay?
Just the usual stuff. If you enjoy the show, why not give us a shout out on iTunes or Stitcher or review us on whatever medium you listen to us on. Send a nice tweet about us. We're on Twitter at WorstFoot. Ben's on at Ben Vanderveld. I'm at Baz McStay. We're also on Facebook, and you can find our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And I think that's probably enough for this week.
I think it probably is.
Prepare to tuck in to the first course at the world's worst restaurant. He won Bake Off!
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us in Casa Pier Pier en Avant, our new high-end Michelin-star brasserie, where we've decided to push the boundaries of molecular gastronomy, slow cooking, and sustainable eating by reusing old Formula One tyres and turning them into fine dining dishes, which we then sell back to Bernie Eccleston and his beanie baby wives. As you come into our bistro, we'll take your coat, pop it in the cloakroom, shred it down into strips, and send it directly to the kitchen to turn into delicious hors d'oeuvres. The waiters are all pitmen who aim to get your meal ordered, served, and cleared in 8.5 seconds before charging you the GDP of a small African country and booting you out into the world with empty bellies and emptier wallets. And with me is the suave maitre d' to my ketchup-stained apron, the lithe Charles Campion to my mini Jay Rayner. It's Barry McStay.
It's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. you and I, we've been in some nice restaurants. You do a dinner club. Do you still do dinner club?
Nah, not anymore. We used to, God, this is like 6-7 years ago, yeah, before the very thought of being a parent occurred to me. Where, yeah, me and my wife and 3 or 4 of our mates decided to eat our way through the alphabet A to Z in terms of restaurants.
Yeah.
Go to a nice posh restaurant every 3-4 months.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Did I tell you the one time we ate in a Michelin star restaurant, my husband and I? I booked for us to go on a anniversary weekend away to a place up in the Lake District. It was very nice. And it was like a hotel, small 30-room hotel, and then it had like little spa lodges on the grounds as well. So I booked one of those, and it was like an all-inclusive 2 meals thrown in, three nights sort of thing. And after I booked this all-inclusive thing and paid for it, they then got awarded a Michelin star and jacked all of their prices up. But of course, I had already paid for my experience. Michelin star food for pre-Michelin star prices.
That's such a good blast. So it took me ages to sort of, as a poor, starving, self-employed artist, having met my lawyer wife going, what? We're paying for this once, and I'm only going to see it again one more time, and it's not going to look as pretty as it currently does now. But no, I really enjoy going to real high-end establishments and knowing that I should not be there and acting appropriately.
I do feel like sometimes you go to places and go, should I take your coat, sir? Actually, no, keep it on, turn around and leave again.
Yeah.
Sign of the vibe.
I feel like John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and the Blues Brothers going into that New York brasserie.
Yeah. Let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a cook, food writer, and international health advisor. That's someone who can give you food poisoning anywhere in the world, but also knows which local medication will set you right again. Raised in a Christian family, he eventually moved to London and came out as gay. Wait, is it me? Am I the guest this week?
Yes,
you are.
I will not take any of your dietary advice.
He now works for voluntary services overseas, delivering healthcare programs and teaching nurses in developing countries, during which job he's been evacuated from two war zones. Now, to some, once may seem like an accident. Twice, you begin to see a pattern emerging. You start to think, maybe you just like seeing the men in uniforms. He's also had malaria 9 times, once more, and he's entitled to a free coffee.
His greatest with mosquito milk.
Yeah. His greatest claim to fame, however, is that he won the 10th series of the Great British Bake Off, the second winner we've had on after winner of Series 1, Ed Kimber. So I look forward to continuing the sequence in a few years by adding on another zero and having on the winner of Series 100. He also enjoys pottery. Mate, you know there's a reality show for pottery too. Unify the titles! Come on!
Also, like, hang on, the 100th Bake Off, that is going to be at the start of the 22nd century.
Yeah.
That's going to be like a Mad Max Thunderdome Bake Off.
He only got on Bake Off as a last-minute replacement and won the whole thing despite never having won a Weekly Star Baker Award. Just our kind of guy, coast through the school year and then cram for the final exam.
That also makes you, and this is a very niche reference, the Denmark football team from 1992 going to the Euros.
That's very true. He now writes a cookery column for The Guardian on food and fitness. Sorry, I don't understand. Food and fitness. That doesn't compute. And his first book, My First Cookbook, will be published later this year. The title, of course, leaves open the tantalising possibility of branching into other areas. If you're doing My First Cookbook, then perhaps down the line we'll see My First Children's Book, My First IKEA Instruction Manual, and My First Sacred Text, possibly of a religion that worships pies. Perhaps Christianity. Please welcome, not the winner of the Rear of the Year, but certainly Britain's Least Soggy Bottom 2019... David Atherton.
Hey guys.
Hello.
And actually, I was evacuated from the same country twice, so I
did, yeah. Which one?
The Ivory Coast.
Yeah. Did you not get a warning? Did I say don't come back?
Yeah, at the time it was actually above Iraq on the countries not to visit.
Wow.
But it was below Afghanistan, so.
Just like living dangerously.
Yeah.
And have you been to Malawi and lots of other different places?
Yeah, Papua New Guinea, Zambia, Ethiopia. Yeah, the best bit about all these countries is the food, every time.
Really?
Nice. Yeah. What's the best cake you have had from one of these countries, which I don't naturally associate with cakes?
You invented a cake, didn't you?
Yeah, probably my own. Well, like, places don't really have ovens necessarily, so it's a very... You have cakes when you have ovens.
Actually, well, this because we've got an Ethiopian restaurant down the world, and they down the world, down the
yeah, the other side, yeah, the other side of the Sahara,
yeah, it's on the east of Africa. Because they eat with injera, that really lovely sort of lemony. It's not a naan bread. What is it?
It's a pancake.
Yeah,
it's made from a grain that's only grown in Ethiopia called teff.
Oh, right.
And they let it go sour. They let it go off. That's why it's got the lemony taste.
It's nice. It's amazing.
It's like a thin crumpet, though, isn't it? A massive thin crumpet.
Big fan of thin crumpet.
But the cake you made is to be made on a fire outdoors. Is that the idea?
Yeah, so it's like it was a steamed cake. And it was using avocados instead of butter.
Ooh.
It was delicious. It wasn't... I mean, I wouldn't necessarily eat it in this country. But it was nice when it was an alternative and there was nothing else.
Okay.
That sounds like something from a colonial cookbook, wouldn't it? So it's very good for the colonials, but when I'm back in Blighty, no thank you.
Congratulations on winning Bake Off, but you're keeping the two jobs up as well. You're not.
No, I love my job, so I'm still doing that work. And I've done it for quite a long time, so it'd be a waste, I think, to kind of stop it now.
Yeah.
I also have to say a particular well done for winning Bake Off, because for the past 5-6 years, me and my wife have done a sweepstake on it, where we'll watch the first two episodes, and then before the second chuck out, we will write down the names in an envelope and put them in, and I chose you, and my wife was
furious.
And who did she choose? Hopefully another finalist. Just to make it even more appalling.
No, she absolutely dropped a ball this year. She normally wins, but she went for someone, I can't remember who, had a decent, like a solid first couple of weeks. Because with the editing, sometimes you go, well, they just, you know, almost won top baker 2 weeks running. It's definitely going to be them. And she fell for that. And it was somebody totally fucked a technical in the semis.
That's good, because you weren't the favourite going into the final, pretty much. No, obviously, you don't know that, because they've already filmed it in advance, but yeah, there was...
No, I think... No, but I mean, I hadn't won Star Baker, but here's an interesting fact for the, like, stats, is that the person that wins the bake-off is nearly always the person that's done best in the technical, not Star Bakers.
Yeah.
And I've actually got the best technical record for anyone ever on bake-off.
Yeah.
So I should have won the technical.
I love it. There are people who are like spread bettors who are looking at the form book now. Yeah. Like, you know, if it's horse racing, you look at like whether the ground is firm to medium, basically. You're like, right, who's doing the technicals?
But however, David has now given your wife a surefire way of winning next year.
She doesn't listen to this podcast.
Actually, there's people who, like, last year, there's people who guess, they can work out the positions of the bakers week one based on their social media from the past, from, like, where, because they go back and look at what your social media was like during the show.
Ah.
And last year, they got it almost entirely correct. So for our year, we knew this, so we made sure we went back to our social media and made sure that we'd... We're trying to not give as many hints as possible.
To keep it fairly even, yeah.
Oh, what? So there was a sudden spike in excitement during the filming.
Well, also, if you kind of went to Pride Parade and posted a picture, and then the people who, like, know when the filming started be like, okay, well, you definitely weren't in a week 5 weeks.
Oh, shit.
Things like that. So we were quite clever about going back through and making sure. So if you went out, you shouldn't really post anything on the weekend.
Or you have to post at everything. Either you don't post, or you go, we're going to the Pride Parade, we're going to the protests against the Pride Parade. We're going to be at every possible public event.
I actually suggested that those of us who got quite far should have posted as well for things and, like, just pretended we did things on the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah, throw them off the scent.
That's a big lump of subterfuge.
So we know that you're very good at baking and at subterfuge. What are you worst at in the world?
I'm worst at drinking. I don't like water in general. I don't like washing. Swimming, anything like that. But I'm like the least hydrated person you would meet. And part of that's I've got a very small bladder. Like, biologically, I've got a tiny bladder. So I think you've given me half a cup of tea and I've already been to the toilet twice. So in general, I'll have sometimes just one drink the whole day.
Is that the reason for cake then? Because, you know, a sponge will just absorb.
Yeah, absorbs all the liquid.
Do you drink alcohol?
No, I don't drink alcohol.
Okay, fine. Because that's like an immediate open the floodgates.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
So you shouldn't beat yourself up about it. You're just very efficient. And that sort of, that fits with you being so good at technicals as well. You're just kind of like, you're a wonderfully engineered human.
Yeah, passes through the system good and quick. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not what I want with my cakes. I want my cakes to linger. Barry, you're going to go first.
Before I pick some really terrible restaurants, and oh boy, there's a lot, but I thought I'd read about the Michelin Guide, first of all. Basically, it's the way over here we imagine the best restaurants are chosen. It's not necessarily the case, and it's only been in certain countries around the world for a very short period of time.
Yeah.
I think the Michelin Guide, for the first one for America, only was published in the 2000s or something, so it's fairly recent. But I read about the history of it. The Michelin brothers, Andre and Edouard, started their Michelin Guide in 1900, and they were, they're the Michelin tire people. It's not a different Michelin, it's the same people. And the reason they did it is, at the turn of the 20th century, there were only about 2,200 cars in France. And they knew it was going to take off eventually. But basically, they had a tyre business which was only servicing 2,200 cars. So they thought, how can we encourage people to drive longer distances and then therefore need more tyres? So they started publishing a guide which had, you know, interesting places to visit and little hotels and roadside cafes and where you could get gas. And they even went so far as putting up homemade signs to give people directions on the roads. So then it sort of encouraged people to drive further and further.
So it wasn't just food, it was also...
It started as this basic scheme to just get people to drive sightseeing and then to buy their tyres. And actually they gave this guide out for free.
And they only started charging for it in 1920. And then in 1926, they expanded into fine dining and so on. And in 1931, that's when the three stars system came in that they have. They did, you know, obviously they were working at the turn of the century. It was quite a dangerous time to be in Europe. But not for the Michelin brothers. In 1919, less than a year after the end of the First World War, they published a guide that highlighted the battlefields of Europe, encouraging people to go and visit them. Really quite dark. For example, this information on the Battle of the Marne, they said the information was collected even before the smoke of the battle had cleared away. I'll remind you, this is just some guys who want to sell tires. But their maps, they had maps in the guides, they were so good that both the Germans and the Allies used Michelin guides in World War II to help themselves navigate across Europe. I read then about how the inspectors operate for the Michelin guide. They're trained in France. They don't take notes while they eat. Unlike a lot of food critics, when they visit restaurants, they'll take notes. And apparently Michelin, in theory, you won't have any idea whether they've been. Some of them will visit the same restaurant over and over again before casting a judgment on it. According to a former inspector, Pascal Remy, who went into the open in the 2000s and blew the lid on this case, he said in France there were more than 10,000 restaurants and only 5 inspectors. So he said, sometimes they're giving ratings and reviews for places they have definitely not been to.
Also, when you say they go back again and again because they can't write something down, is their meal paid for every single time?
Yeah, their meal is paid for all the time. So
if you quite like one, it's like, yeah. Just need to go one more time.
I wasn't sure.
What was that dessert I tried?
Yeah, I can't remember. And there were 2 desserts I wanted to try. I just have to make sure
I get
both.
Well, that's the thing, you can't just give a Michelin star based on one meal. You've got to, you know, pick and choose bits of the menu.
Yeah, apparently they spend like half the year on the road in hotels and things around the country.
And a lot of the time, one of the complaints was it wasn't just food, was it? It's about the experience. So therefore, some places that had amazing food didn't have iron tablecloths. So.
And they're very covert about what their actual criteria are, what they're judging on. Have you heard of Jay Fay's restaurant?
No.
This is in Bangkok, it's on the Maha Chai Road, and it's a shop house. It's just an open air, green tiled walls, simple tables and stools, and she does street food. And this woman, Jay Fay, she works in the restaurant 6 days a week. It's just on a little alleyway. 2 charcoal braziers cooking her food. Her name, Jay Fay, means Sister Mole, because when she cooks, she wears little ski goggles to stop her. So as you can see, I think she must need glasses, but they don't steam up in the same way. She charges much higher prices, obviously, than most street food. Some of her dishes cost over like $30 and so on. But a 1999 review in the Bangkok Post described her as one of those increasingly rare Mozarts of the noodle pan. That's such a great phrase.
But there's the Michelin star is a curse, isn't it, for some?
Yeah.
There was one recently where they got the Michelin star, and then the next year they just said it was a disaster because they got booked up too much, couldn't cope with it, and then the expectations were too high. And
yeah, some chefs give them back because they don't want to have to deal with the pressure. Some of them, there have been cases of chefs committing suicide and that being linked to the fact they'd lost Michelin stars or were about to lose them. This woman, Jay Fay, in 2017, the Michelin Guide released its first edition for Bangkok. In 2018, her restaurant was awarded 1 star. Only a street restaurant. And so it resulted in a huge number of customers coming along to her. She'd never heard of the guide and had to be persuaded to attend the ceremony. And apparently they had to implement a booking system, which she hated and didn't want to ever have to do. One of her daughters left her job to join her full time. She says she's never written down a recipe and she's not going to pass on the business because it's earned enough already. And not only that, she says the stress of being targeted now by government auditors and having to deal with the customers and her neighbours who are now pissed off at how many people are outside her restaurant all the time is too much for her. Marco-Pierre White gave back his stars. He gave them back. He had got 3 stars for restaurant Marco-Pierre White and gave them back 5 years later. He said, people with less knowledge than me were being given the same award and suddenly it didn't mean as much. That's Marco-Pierre White.
Yeah, that's on brand.
But my favourite Michelin story is the Michelin guide for France in 2017 awarded a star to a restaurant called Bouche à Oreille. It means word of mouth. And the owner, Veronica Jacquet, said, we're swamped. Little bar restaurant in the town of Bourg. I don't have much space. There are only 4 waiters. And regulars there would pay €12.50 for homemade beef bourguignon. And they'd eat on, you know, those red and white tablecloths. It was basically just a roadside cafe for truck drivers. And the problem was the Michelin guide had confused it with the other Bouche à Oreille restaurant, 180 kilometres north of it near Paris, which had carpeted floors, linen tablecloths, and dishes including lobster flan, calf brain, and crunchy pear and chocolate with champagne for €48. They apologised to the 2 establishments. The chef at the restaurant that was meant to get it, Emmerich Drouet, said he called the owner of the other restaurant and the whole thing made us laugh. And the cook at the other restaurant, the one that got it accidentally, Penelope Salmon, which is a great name for the cook, was asked if she ever dreamed of earning a Michelin star. She said, no, not at all. I cook with my heart.
Oh! Like, shots fired in the kitchen.
But I'm going to tell you about some actual terrible restaurants now and get to my choice. In 1994, on the Upper East Side of New York, Twins Restaurant was opened, owned by Lisa and Debbie Gantz, who are identical twins, and Academy Award nominee Tom Berenger. And they opened this restaurant, which had a staff of 29 sets of identical twins.
Absolutely not.
You're a twin.
Yeah, I'm a twin.
Yeah. Identical?
Not identical.
So just fraternal.
He tries to be, but...
No one can ever match this. They said that they found it only took them 2 weeks to find enough pairs of twins to work there. They had twins quit their full-time job. It wasn't about the money. It's about the twin thing. Of course, the twin thing means that employees, you have to work on the same day, at the same time. You have to wear the same outfit. And if one twin calls out sick, the other one isn't allowed to work.
And do they work the same section? Do they have to like work the tables together?
I think they both have to be like, you try and make them visible to the same tables and all that. And if your twin got fired, obviously you got fired as well.
This is terrible. No.
Apparently, the food was quite good. One of the dishes includes twin-themed dishes like Twin Peaks nachos. And if you were a twin, you came to eat in the restaurant, you'd be treated to two-for-one drinks. And they'd have like deals for triplets and quadruplets and all of that. The owners of the restaurant claimed they met over 100,000 sets of multiples during the 5 years they ran the restaurant, and but it closed in the year 2000. However, in 2013, a restaurant opened in Moscow called Twin Stars, which is also staffed entirely by twins. However, this one only has fraternal twins. It's not identical twins. So, David, you could work there with your brother.
Oh, see, I thought Twin Stars was only going to be identical twins that were famous.
Oh, I see. Okay, so again, he doesn't
quite
fit.
Very difficult to staff that one.
I mean, the only famous identical twins I can think of are those two little fat, round, ginger actors who appeared in Erie, Indiana in the mid-90s. This is very niche.
What is the Olsen twins? Are they identical? Charlie Carver and his the non-gay twin from Desperate Housewives.
Man United had a pair of fullbacks.
Nevilles.
No, not the Nevilles. like a pair of Brazilian fullbacks.
Oh, yeah, Fabio and Rafael.
That's the one. Yeah.
Okay, fine. We've got up to about five pairs of twins. Yeah.
That's a restaurant.
Yeah, forget the podcast. That's where the real money is, guys. You would hate to eat in that restaurant. You'd be creeped out. I would hate to eat in Disaster Cafe in Lore de Mar in Spain on the Costa Bravo. Have you heard of this place?
This sounds like somewhere which is going to be, like, teetering on the edge of a cliff.
Oh, no, it's not, Ben. But actually, the ground level is an alien-themed restaurant for children, where it's decorated like a spaceship. But an elevator takes I think it's an adults only restaurant down into the ground, the depths of the earth, where they're seated in like a cave. And you'll notice that the staff are wearing construction helmets and the safety equipment, and when the food comes, the dishes are really heavy for some reason. And that's because you never know when a 7.8 on the Richter scale earthquake might be simulated in the restaurant. It's not even like it's on a fault line, they simulate an earthquake. And I don't know my Richter scale, but 7.88 sounds really high.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a teeth rattler.
How many waivers do you have to sign to go down?
Yeah, alone.
Also, I would really hope that they only serve soup and wobbly trifles.
They do recommend you don't wear your best clothes in the restaurant. And I've seen, there's a video of it on YouTube. You can go and find like a 30-second video of it happening. And it's just... It's hard. I don't understand. I go to a restaurant, have a really nice meal. I don't get the like medieval times vibe, you know, or any of those like novelty. There's a robot restaurant in Tokyo where it's like basically like eating in a theme park.
There's the Pitch Black one as well.
Yeah, there's a Dan Lenoir.
Yeah, you don't even know what you're eating.
Yeah, who's serving you?
Yeah,
it could be twins.
Or who's at your table, twins. I guess.
Yeah.
No, it's just paedophiles on day release. Wondering about them. I absolutely haven't got a clue.
Or maybe it's members of the royal family.
Yeah.
Like I said, like
paedophiles on day release.
On the novelty restaurant theme, Ninja in Tribeca in New York. Have you found this?
Yeah. I like the idea of this one.
I fucking hate this. The decor is like a feudal ninja village. It's basically like a crap crystal maze zone. There are ninja stars printed on the napkins. You can get a ninja star martini, which instead of the umbrella has a ninja star poked in the side of it. Each table is at a private pagoda. The waiters are dressed as ninjas and basically burst into your little side rooms going, "Hi-ya! May I take your order?" And there's like secret doors and sliding windows. So suddenly you'll be eating food and like a knife will appear at your throat. And it's really upsetting. And also it has that horrible like thing of, instead of just giving you your food and fucking off, the waiter will come along and go, "Now you all need to stab this food with your chopsticks, or you need to pull the knife out of this to release the flavor." You're like, "Please just put it down and let me eat my food."
See, I always wanted to be a ninja growing up. That was one of my ideal jobs, so I think this is my restaurant.
For listeners, David is wearing a black polo neck, black jeans.
Yeah, and when he arrived today, it was via the roof.
Yeah.
And turned suction cups on the window. David, upside down, knocking me. He's very polite ninja.
Couple more before I give you my choice. Modern Toilet, which is a chain in Taiwan, according to their homepage, harnessing the hitherto untapped potential of using the bathroom as a venue for dining. The restaurant is a scatological fantasy land. The place is decorated with toilet seats and toilet bowls. You sit on a porcelain throne, you dine at sinks turned into tables, and some of the dishes are served in miniature toilets and urinals, and the chocolate ice cream is served in a gently squeezed out curl, very deliberately. Cabbages and Condoms, which is a restaurant that began in Bangkok. If you didn't want the street food of Sister Mole, then you could go here and you can eat some classic Thai food in the busy business district. And it's decorated with lots of condoms. The dresses on the mannequins in the place are made. Yeah, it's a restaurant with mannequins, first of all. That's already bad enough.
Yeah, the mannequins are really creepy.
It's really upsetting. There are lamps with condoms on them, strings of lights made of condoms, and instead of a mint after dinner, you get a condom.
Did you know, I looked into their website, and they have restaurants in Thailand and also Cheltenham and Bicester. So,
amazing.
Worst Foot Forward day out to
absolutely
cabbages and condoms.
Absolutely, please donate to patreon.com.
Condoms to take home still mint and tingly.
Oh, with a layer of chocolate around them as well.
Surely sauerkraut.
After 8 inches. they want you to know that their food is guaranteed not to cause pregnancy. And the reason it's got this weird name is apparently it started out as a little vegetable stand in the offices of the PDA, which is the Population and Community Development Association, and it works in primary health and education and combating HIV and AIDS and rural development. Really, a really worthy cause, actually. Ooh. And this little stand sold vegetables as well as lace panties, t-shirts, keychains, and then condoms and oral contraceptives as like a social health thing. And then eventually the chairman called it Cabbages and Condoms just because it was a catchy name, and it drew curious people into the shop. So in the 70s he added it to the restaurant, and it's now big enough to seat 400 people.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's huge. But my choice of the world's best restaurant is the Heart Attack Grill.
Is the chef Anthony Worrell Thompson?
The chef, or the guy who owns it certainly, is a guy who, and I'm using inverted commas here, calls himself Dr. John Basso, because this is a hospital-themed restaurant in downtown Las Vegas. It embraces and promotes an unhealthy diet. Customers are called patients, orders are called prescriptions, and the waitresses are dressed as and call themselves nurses. And anyone who weighs over 350 pounds can eat unlimited food for free, assuming they will weigh themselves on an electronic cattle scale in front of the cheering restaurant crowd.
What is 350 pounds in hour?
It is, yeah, 25 stone. Their menu includes the single bypass burger, the double bypass burger, the triple bypass burger, the quadruple bypass, it continues on to octuple bypass burger. And just to make you realise how bad this is, the quadruple bypass burger was awarded the title of the world's most calorific burger by Guinness World Records. It has a calorie count of 9,983 calories, and that's only halfway up their burger scale. They still have an octuple bypass burger, which hasn't been rated by Guinness, presumably because they need hazmat suits and, you know, they can't get close enough to it. There's Lucky Strike cigarettes available. There's candy cigarettes for kids, which is absolutely fucking vile. And people who are unable to finish their meals are subjected to spankings publicly delivered by one of the nurses. Dr. John refers to them as pain management therapy. If you do finish one of the quadruple burgers, though, the restaurant has a free wheelchair service. the patients are pushed in a wheelchair out to their cars. And yeah, it was founded in 2005. In late 2010, it became the number one most globally searched internet term thanks to some viral videos by their supersized spokesman, Blair River. Blair died in early 2011 at the age of 29 from pneumonia complicated by his 570-pound body weight.
Oh, no.
In 2013, their new spokesman, a guy called John Allman, collapsed outside of the restaurant and also died, having not missed a day's attendance at the restaurant. He was cremated and his ashes are on display above the bar in the restaurant. And in February 2012, a customer suffered another apparent heart attack while eating a triple bypass burger. They were taken to hospital. Apparently, people eating in the restaurant thought it was a stunt and started taking photographs of it. The owner said, "I actually felt horrible for the gentleman because the tourists were taking photos of him as if it was some type of stunt. Even with our own morbid sense of humour, we would never pull a stunt like that." I think they got just what they deserve for that, frankly. And,
I entirely agree.
If people want to read more about it, they can. He is a thoroughly unlikable, unapologetic man who says he's combating political correctness.
I mean, that's an immediate red flag.
The only way he's combating politically correctness is if all of his clients are politically correct and he's then poisoning them all.
I don't even really know what a restaurant is. I remember being quite horrified when I went to America and being told I was going to be taken to a restaurant for dinner and actually being British, kind of dressed up a little bit before being taken to McDonald's, which is not a restaurant. Surely that's not a restaurant.
I feel like you say, if you're going to take someone to McDonald's, you say, "I'm taking you to McDonald's," because that's
a, in America, it's a thing. Everything's a restaurant.
Yeah.
Americans' approaches to eating. I was on holiday in New Orleans a couple of years ago, and you get service with a smile, but you know, over here, if you go to a nice restaurant, the waiter wants to get to know you and have a little bit of a chat. They are normally not British, which is why they are so polite. But in America, it's like service with a smile, but also service on a conveyor belt. And, you know, no postprandials, no sort of like having a good 45-minute chat with coffee and mint. It's like, come on, chop chop, we got another table coming in.
Yeah. Presumably you've been around the world, you've eaten in lots of different interesting places.
Yeah, and actually even in the UK, when you talk about Michelin-starred restaurants, I've eaten in quite a few of those before I've now been invited to restaurant launches and things.
Yeah. You're clearly discerning your own right.
No. When I came to London, I had no money at all, and I was working a part-time job. And so I signed up to Mystery Dining and then wrote really good reviews. So then I got they started sending me to the really top restaurants.
Nice.
So I went to some really big restaurant launches and was sitting next to celebrities and things. And like you, like, had no idea what to do. Like, it was embarrassing when I would try to take my own drink to the table from the bar and realise that someone was meant to carry that behind me.
They get really angry when I do that.
Yeah, it's so strange. But I did. I actually found that I really liked that. I turned into a complete diva. Because you can order what you want, and obviously you are judging them. And
so my wife to Heston Blumenthal's one dinner in the Mandarin Hotel, which is, you know, it's by Hyde Park. Every other table is definitely like a Russian oligarch. So if I'm that, I just like to pretend I'm an arms dealer. Just like talk openly about the shipments of AK-47s that I've got coming in. You know, just go, "Oh, business is great in Yemen at the moment."
I really enjoy the, because in those really nice restaurants, you get like the waiters are always like ready to like push your chair in behind you. So I try to get into a little tug of war where I keep pushing it. Like, sitting there for like 10 seconds, going, "No, he won't push me in. I want to sit this far away from the table."
If you want to be really game, you should sort of get there when they go, like, "Can we take your coat for the cloakroom?" And take off your coat and then take off your jacket and start taking off your shirt and see if they'll play along with it.
Actually, one of them I went to, I turned up in my cycling gear. My full lycra and asked where the toilet was to get changed. And I didn't even get changed, I just changed my shoes.
Nice.
And I sat in my cycling lycra.
Please tell me it was fluorescent yellow.
Oh, it wasn't, it was black. Ninja.
Ninja.
But one I went to, which I obviously can't name the restaurant, but it is named after a certain climbing plant. And the guy there, like, we were going to order something, and he suggested that we have, what are they called? The little Italian rice balls that you deep fry.
Porcini. Is that? No, not porcini.
Mike, I don't think of the word.
Arancini.
Yeah, he suggested me.
Wow, that was the most North London middle class brain melt. All three of us go, "What's the word for the little risotto balls?" Just my heart.
We said it at the same time, like a barbershop trio.
And a ghostly arancini has appeared in the room beside us.
But you can imagine my glee, because obviously I didn't want these. And then he brought them. and I bit into it and it was frozen.
Oh.
And obviously, he must have been quite confused because most people would be quite disgusted, whereas I was just thinking, this is going to be great in the report. But yeah, so I went to quite a lot of good restaurants with that, with the mystery dining. I think it was kind of generally a good experience.
Yeah.
And now, I am now disappointed when I go to restaurants that are quite nice because I want to be writing a report. I want to be judging them and critiquing, and now I just get given nice food and just expected to enjoy it.
What the TripAdvisor was invented for people like you.
Well, yeah, because what record? But then does TripAdvisor now? Do you find the worst restaurants from TripAdvisor? I don't think
no,
so.
No, I don't. Yeah, you go. You only read the negative reviews on TripAdvisor to get a laugh. I don't think you actually take them seriously because definitely the people who write 1-star reviews on TripAdvisor, I am imagining, based on my experience of working in a job where we get reviewed on TripAdvisor, mm-hmm. the people who write 1-star reviews have not had 1-star experiences. They just think they have.
Yeah, or they're just people from other restaurants trolling you.
Yeah, that's also true.
Surely that's like the first thing. As soon as a new restaurant comes along, anyone that owns restaurants in the area are just going to give loads of 1-star, 2-star reviews.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think people will honestly be that underhand?
Yes.
Are you going to do that when you release your cookbook and start writing negative reviews about media and Christmas? Yeah. See, that's been the Christmas number one for far too long.
Yeah, definitely. But, okay, one of my worst restaurants was when I was living in the Ivory Coast. And I can't remember the name of this restaurant, probably being blocked out of memory. But I was running a bit late, which isn't like me. I like to be very early for things.
Yeah.
And so I arrived quite hot and sweaty because it's a hot country. And I sat down, we were sitting around in a circle, and I turned to the waitress and asked for some water, and then was just chatting to my friend, trying to catch up because I was late. And I was passed some water, and so I drank it, not realising it was the water that had been passed around for everyone to wash their hands.
Oh no!
I felt quite sick when I looked down into the water, and it was just dirty, it was disgusting.
Oh no.
But the best bit was that about a week later, I then got worms that were such impressive worms that they actually swam against the flush. After you'd flush, these black, silvery ones, and they would swim against the flush and they'd still be in the toilet afterwards.
Guys, I don't know if that's a restaurant's fault, though.
Well, that's true.
And you were late, so presumably everyone had done their hands by the time it got to you
as
well.
Yeah, it gone right round the room. Also, don't drink out of a massive bowl of water.
Yeah. Having said that, to be fair, the first time I was in a Chinese restaurant where they had, like, finger bowls for you to wash it, like, it's a bowl with a lemon in it, and I was like, is this some sort of food?
A very basic soup.
Yeah.
Also, I went to the Biennale in Venice.
Oh, nice. Oh,
wow. And I went to a restaurant there, and actually we had an okay experience, but then I found out that I think they'd had to kind of up their game a bit, because they'd charged some Japanese tourists £1,000.
Oh.
There was four of them. Oh, the name of the restaurant, I don't know how to speak Italian. Osteria De Luca, it looks like the name
that
is.
That sounds pretty good.
And yeah, and apparently that's quite a common practice in these in Venice. They just, when people come in and don't look at the menu properly and just order, they just take the opportunity then to charge ridiculous amounts.
Whatever they want.
So
whatever.
I just think it doesn't really matter how good your food is. It's not going to be really worth that, is it? Apparently it's because it was weighed meat. Like, they asked for, I think, fish or steaks that were weighed by weight.
You know, that's someone who didn't just have their finger on the scale, had an entire fist on the scale.
Just leaning on it, yeah.
Was the food, was the food decent?
It was all right. It wasn't that good, though.
Yeah.
But I think the mayor of Venice, if there's a mayor of Venice, weighed in on it because they no one could actually force them to give this money back. They actually did have to pay the £1,000,
yeah,
for this meal. Yeah.
God, who'd hate an Italian city to be brought into disrepute by criminal activity? Perish the thoughts, gentlemen.
In fairness, maybe it's just part of Venice's wide-ranging scheme to discourage tourists from coming there because they keep sinking the city.
Yeah. Well, no, only tourists who've been to the Heart Attack Grill first.
Yeah, yeah. That'll sink it even quicker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, no, what you need to do is when it floods, you get someone from the Heart Attack Grill to do a swan dive into it, and then by displacement of water, it'll just go back out into the Adriatic and the Mediterranean. That's how fluid dynamics works, right, guys?
Sounds about right, yeah.
Cool.
My question as well is, you know, restaurants now, we keep on seeing all these hygiene things. I'm sure that wasn't there before.
Like the scores on the doors and like 5-star hygiene.
Yeah.
Hygiene, right?
Where
did that come from? There's a Chinese takeaway on Fortis Road that has got maybe a 4, maybe a 3. And listen, I know that you need, I think you might legally have to display it, but...
Yeah, I think you must do.
You know, obviously you can have like a Michelin one, or there's a Best Eats, and there's all sorts of different awards, but literally the only thing they have is 3-star hygiene rating.
Yeah, you try and hide, put that at the bottom and then just get loads of other stickers. Just get those ones you used to have in your car when you visited. Yeah. Just put them all over the window.
Just one of Snoopy.
Yeah, just so no one can see them. Like, but my one of my favourite restaurants that I went to in Lewisham, again and again, it's an Indian restaurant, did amazing dosa. And then I took a friend one time and she looked at the door and realised it was 2-star.
Wow.
But the food is amazing. So like, what?
It's the feces that gives it that extra taste.
It's like the worst best restaurant.
2 is quite right.
You
might have again, tested some of the food for 2.
I think like, I feel like 3 is my kitchen. Sorry, 3 is my kitchen when I've been unsupervised by my wife.
Yeah. When it's 6 is your wife.
There you go.
You know, I do this when I order food on Just Eat or something like that, because there's like star ratings on that where people rate or however good the food was. We moved to a new area last year and we'd been ordering from the same Chinese restaurant for ages. So you knew the food was good. So you move to a new area, obviously you've got to find, where's your new delivery place? So I'll go on Just Eat and look at the star ratings of everywhere and go, okay, these ones are the ones that are rated highest. Now, which of them charges the little bit more for the food? And then go, okay, we're going to order from the place that's like a pound more expensive and test that theory. Because if the food in here with its star rating isn't good, then it's no point scraping the bottom of the barrel with the other ones.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, that extra little pound premium is means that, you know, they've spent a bit more on Dettol.
That's the very liquid.
Yeah.
When I was in Ethiopia, we were just talking about Ethiopia and those lovely pancakes. I love the food there, the kind of stewy wats that you have with that injera bread.
It's amazing.
But what you realise when you go to Ethiopia is that a lot of the time they serve you raw meat with it. So it's not these lovely lentily, vegetally stews. And this was for breakfast as well. I could handle the raw beef. I could even handle the raw cow's tongue, which was very chewy. It was like a tasteless Haribo sweet. But then, you know the kind of cows you get in Ethiopia have that big hump, that fatty hump? Yeah. Someone then tried to give me a slice of the raw cow hump, and that pushed me over the edge. I don't think I ate for the rest of the day.
Are these in like chunks or is it minced?
No, it's chunks, yeah, slices.
Oh, like
everyone else was eating it with drinking lots of alcohol, I presume, to kind of kill any bugs and things.
I've got this horrible image in my head that they do it while the cow's alive and they're like slice it off.
Like the cow in the restaurant at the end of the universe, Douglas Adams. Recommending itself.
Precisely, but if you're having carpaccio of cow hump, then you slice it off and let it grow back a bit, and then, obviously the first layer's a bit chewy, so you go down to the second layer.
Yeah, like those people that have the blood. That kind of just tap the blood of the cows
in
Kenya.
It's incredible.
They tap blood from them.
Yeah, so they basically get like the side of, not a machete, but whatever the knife is, and they basically slap the jugular and the blood just pisses out the side into a pot, and they drink the blood and eat the coagulated blood, and then they
just pinch it.
Pinch it.
Yeah, stop the bleeding. Because then the thing is, you're keeping the cow alive. Like, blood is really good for you.
Yeah.
And you get, instead of just killing an animal that you've just got to have all the meat all then, you can just keep on tapping them.
Are they aware of milk? Those cows have an inbuilt tap.
I do feel like the cow must be giving them a bit of side eye going, you're doing it wrong.
Other end, mate, other end.
Another thing I liked, which I think is amazing but a lot of people don't like, is when I lived in Malawi, one of their delicacies is called Nyam Nyam Bewa, which is a mouse. Wow. But it's like you get the mouse and you boil it, the whole mouse. And then you take it out, you rub salt on it and kind of leave it to dry, and then you eat it all. So the feet, the legs, bones, skin. The weirdest bit is fur. The rest is kind of edible, but fur just kind of, you can't really chew fur very well, so it clogs your mouth. And also, I didn't realise most people spit out the teeth. You can't really eat teeth. Whereas I just kind of swallowed those.
But then again, we've all done that, you know, there's the furry outside of a kiwi fruit, and then, you know, it's got the slightly chewy seeds in the middle of it as well. So I just imagine I'm eating a kiwi fruit.
What did it taste like?
Malawians call it a Malawian sausage, but it didn't taste like sausage. It didn't taste bad at all. The head wasn't very nice because the brain was a bit bitter.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it just tasted salty and meaty.
Oh, you're a better man.
Yeah, generally was quite. I actually quite liked that.
After you'd eaten it, did you then lick your hands and then just use them to clean your face and mouth?
And then my number one of the kind of stranger, well, from our conditioning, stranger foods, was when I was in the Philippines and I had balot, which is a duck egg.
Oh, yeah.
And it's delicious. Inside there's a duck embryo. I did the disgusting thing of like pulling it all apart, putting out this little jelly duck. It's got its
Are you meant to do that? Was that just you being scientific?
Yeah, you just eat it. You're just meant to eat it. But you break open the egg and it's this, there's a little soupy bit inside which is just delicious.
Mm.
And then you've got like the rich duck egg, which is lovely. And then you've just got the most tender piece of duck you'd ever eat.
Because it's not even a duckling yet.
It's got a beak. Everything's jellified, so it's got a beak and it's got eyes and a little hair.
What were you, jelly deals? Jelly duck isn't too far.
Okay, I do not include me in that way. By the way, not a vegan, not a vegetarian, happily eat sweetbreads, but something about necking a tiny little baby duckling, no.
See, I'm actually a vegetarian, but where I travel, as respect to culture, I also just like to try everything. But that restaurant, the reason why I was annoyed at that restaurant wasn't because of the duck egg. It's because it was a restaurant where I sat down and broke the stool. Which is just always humiliating, isn't it? When is that not humiliating, to break a chair that you're sitting on?
Did the restaurant do that thing of everyone cheering?
Yeah.
Or is that just a British and Irish thing? It does it every time. You hear a tray drop, we all want to go, yay!
The thing is, it's become such a trope now that all it gets is like half-hearted. Yeah, cheers, and I'm like, got to do this now, keep up our reputation as being the banter island. Yay.
I had a waiter in a restaurant in Dublin spill an entire bowl of tzatziki down my back. And that's not a euphemism.
Yeah.
I didn't have a spare shirt with me, so I had to go into the bathroom and take a shirt off and dab it with loo roll. And then just like, you know, sit with a damp, sticky tzatziki back for the rest of the meal.
Did they give you a meal for free though, I'm hoping?
He did. I think he gave me my chips for free. I don't think he gave me the whole thing. Again, not a euphemism.
I feel like tzatziki back, potentially one of Batman's greatest enemies. You've heard of Two-Face. Now, sin fear of tzatziki back. Do you have like a restaurant above all that you think is the absolute worst, the absolute pits?
No, but I'm just going to go for the one that gave me worms.
The Ivory Coast.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the restaurant. That's the thing.
Okay, so should we give it a name now? Ivory Worms.
Fine.
But again, I will reiterate, it was your fault for drinking the bowl of dirty water.
True. But where was their hygiene rating? You passed around a bowl of dirty water to wash your hands in.
This is 2-star hygiene rating right here.
It's not.
It's like a really grim version of Pass the Parcel. Eventually, someone's going to get the worms. Or, you know that drinking game where everyone pours a bit of their drink into a pint glass in the middle of it and then you have to drink it?
Like, obviously, the world is an enormous place and different culinary cultures have different delicacies, but there must be some times where you're thinking, are they playing What Can We Get the White Man to Eat? And of all the times when you've done that and all the exotic countries you've been to, it's drinking water is the one that's fucked you up the most.
You've eaten mouse, you've eaten baby duckling and its egg.
Yeah.
Water! Yeah. And your nemesis!
The Eternity Restaurant in Ukraine. The entire restaurant is set in the world's biggest coffin. And its owner, Stepan Pirianik, is the local undertaker.
Amazing.
Who I presume sort of like measures you before you sit down for your meal. The whole place is decorated with funeral paraphernalia, and the menu includes things like 9 days and the 40-day salad, which relate to Ukrainian mourning rituals, and a really ominous sounding dish of let's meet in paradise.
Do they serve chicken Kiev though? I'm disappointed in any Ukrainian restaurant that doesn't serve Kiev.
Well, yeah, it does, but you cut the chicken Kiev and open it up inside, and instead of like oil and parsley, just the ghost of the chicken comes out going, woo, cock-a-doodle, woo. If you were on holiday in Lebanon, you could go to Buns and Guns, which is a military-themed restaurant in Beirut reflecting the mood of the city during the war with Israel in 2006. I imagine pissed off. There are helicopter sounds playing constantly.
Oh, fuck
and,
off.
The menu includes the M16 carbine meat sandwich, a mortar burger, and a terrorist meal. That is vegetarian. I actually went to Kiev. I was filming years ago for an advert, and we went out for dinner at a, I think it was like a Cuban-themed restaurant, so it was like Ukrainian food, but basically pictures of Castro and tanks and weaponry on the walls, and I ate something that was definitely horse.
Buns and Guns sounded like a restaurant that we might want to go to, Barry.
Yeah, I described it. Lee Dan. Yeah, rapid fire.
Yeah.
you know, there's steak and lobster, there's duck and waffle, Buns and Guns.
I'm torn as to whether I'm going to go disgusting or rude for my winner. But a few years ago in Nigeria, in a place called Anambra, police arrested 11 people and closed a restaurant after two human heads wrapped in cellophane were discovered.
Oh, wow.
And it was discovered that the restaurant had been serving human flesh.
No!
It was sold as an expensive treat to restaurateurs and to the guests.
They were aware they were ordering that then? It wasn't like a Sweeney Todd pretending it was cow or something.
Do you know what? That's my biggest regret to do with food, is when I lived in Papua New Guinea, I was offered human flesh, because they still eat it in Papua. They don't kill for it, so it's not... It's illegal to kill someone and then eat
so
it.
So people leave their bodies to restaurants?
Yeah, not to restaurants.
It's kind of donating my body to culinary arts.
No, it's part of the funeral, like part of the thing, like it's the biggest respect if your body is able to live on through your friends and family by people having a piece of you. But there's so many things that...
Do you want a piece of me?
Literally, yes.
Thanks, Grandpa.
But depending on how you died and like... If you had a disease, and all this, there's lots of rules in different parts of the body. But
yeah, what if you die of skin cancer? I'm out.
No.
Yeah.
I'll peel you first.
Yeah. Oh, there's nothing more embarrassing than when you're chowing down on a bit of grandma and they're like, you've not taken the skin off.
This one's a bit wrinkly.
It's meant to be like that. It's a delicacy.
I'm so sorry to our listeners in Papua New Guinea, because we do have someone for being completely disrespectful to your funeral rites.
Do we have listeners in Papua New Guinea?
Apparently we had three last month.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, if you're a listener in Papua New Guinea, firstly, as Barry said, sorry.
Secondly, do you like breast or thighs?
How close did you come to eating some?
Not very close. I was a lot younger than now. Now I'll put anything in my mouth.
It would, good lord. It's always difficult when you get to that part of the funeral in Papua New Guinea when you go, right, so, who's going to carve?
Obviously, if it was a Christian service, you'd go to the communion and be body of Christ, body of your aunt.
Yeah. I think different bits of the human would taste well, because I think if I was going to eat human, I'd want pulled human. I'd want slow cooked.
You're such a hipster.
Do you know what? The testicles are really nice.
I can imagine.
Well, they're not human. Goat's testicles are the ones I eat. But they're really nice. You don't need to slow cook those. They're quick cook.
Yeah.
They're really soft and, yeah.
If you were going to consume another human being, who would you eat?
I think I'd pick Zac Efron.
I think there'd be too many additives.
I think he's not particularly hairy. I think he looks after himself, so like the meat will be good. He's not
too
skinny.
Tough though. Yeah. You want someone that's got muscle, but they don't use it very often.
Okay, yeah.
So kind of like a surfer who's just like naturally born, like people from California who've got those good genetics.
Yeah, or an ex-athlete, Colin Jackson.
Oh.
I'll go Colin Jackson.
Oh yeah.
Hurdlers are a bit stringy.
And we're literally turning into a Sweeney Todd song.
Yeah. I would. Oh gosh, who would I eat? Because you've both gone for sort of like lithe. I want someone who's just like someone.
You want a bit more fast.
Well, no, I want someone with a dad bod. You know, so it's marbled. You know, a little.
The wagyu.
Who is the wagyu of the world today? Who's like that Hollywood wagyu?
Well, he's a bit old now, but like a Robbie Coltrane, you know.
He's beyond wagyu.
Well, he's beyond wagyu, you know. But also, what you imagine that'll be kind of like? It'll be corn fed and, you know, flavored with whiskey.
Do you want
like, I don't know, Billy Connolly jerky?
Would you have like a free range Robbie Coltrane or like a battery Robbie Coltrane?
I really like smoked food, so I might go for a darts player.
Oh, nice.
Because then you've got the sizing. Yeah. Maybe not cigarette smoke, but
yeah,
I do like
the alcohol to it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
What was the guy, the Viking? What was he called?
Oh, yeah.
I know what you mean. Andy Fordham.
Oh, yeah, but then he lost all his weight, so.
Yeah, he didn't. No, that wouldn't be nice. And I don't know, Raymond van Barneveld?
Yeah.
I just feel he'd be like very, very buttery.
Yeah.
And please visit Worst Foot Forward on Twitter to send us your own suggestions of what celebrity you would eat.
Please do.
We're on at Worst Foot. And please make sure to tag David and his agents in it. Yeah.
This neatly brings me on to my next topic. If you're in Japan, you can go to a restaurant called Cannibalistic Sushi.
Oh, no. Wait, hang on. Is it for fish to eat fish?
No. Yeah, it's like one of those foot places that's got out of hand.
The
Of course, the problem with those foot restaurants where you put your feet in the bowls of fish is you got to get there quick, because otherwise David's going to have drunk from them.
Yeah. So there is, I didn't know about this, but apparently there's an old tradition of serving sushi on the body of a naked woman.
Oh yeah, I've heard of this.
And so what they've done instead now is that they've created a fake body. And
everything, all this work is becoming automated so much now.
Yeah, of course. And then the waiter will dissect the body and will offer people different organs of it.
But the meat is made from fish?
The meat's made from fish.
Okay.
As far as I understand.
Interesting.
It's essentially a sushi autopsy. So the what they have is the packaging of the body is made from dough, and the special sauce imitates blood and its viscosity.
Okay.
And apparently all parts of the fake corpse are edible, but not all of the guests dare to try them. And you can choose whether you want a man's body or a woman's body. And if you want, you can personally dissect the corpse.
This sounds great. I mean, that's big. That's a big portion size.
Yeah.
That's like it's a family banquet, that one.
Yeah.
It's like KFC family bucket.
Well, I'm going to go for my penultimate choice. I'm quite staggered that we haven't got here yet, but do you remember when we did World's Worst Wine with Amelia Singer?
Yes.
And we talked about the Chinese predilection for three penis wine.
Yes.
Well, we're going back there.
And what, remind us, what were the penises again?
Gosh, I can't remember what the penises were in three penis wine.
I feel like reindeer.
Yeah.
I've just typed in three penis into Google and forgot to put the wine afterwards. Teji Sanbianju, that's right. Oh yeah, it was seal penis, deer penis, and dog penis.
Wow, it's very much kind of like the city, the countryside, and the sea. I thought of it that way. So in China, there's a restaurant called Gua Li Zhuang, and you can eat an entire menagerie of dongs. You can have dog penis, yak penis, donkey penis, seal penis. You can also order tiger penis, but you have to order it several months in advance. Beyond genitals, there are some really grim delicacies, including stewed deer feces, a sheep fetus in brown garlic sauce, and peacock claws.
Wow.
I mean, I sort of think, you know, we talked on a previous podcast about the guy who would, like, eat aeroplanes.
Yes,
too. I sort of feel like your average Chinese person has a more robust digestive system than him.
I feel like peacock, like, I know, they, obviously, chicken claws is a thing, but I feel like peacock claws is like picking the option from the menu that has lots of E numbers in it.
Yeah. And what's great about it is they give them very poetic names on the menu. So they call things like the essence of the golden Buddha, Phoenix Rising. Looking for treasure in the desert sand.
That's like yak cock.
Yeah. Dragon in the flame of desire.
Depending on the size of your dining party, that could determine the size of the penis. Because obviously if you're eating for one, then maybe it's only cat penis. But if you've got the whole family in, it's a horse penis.
Yeah, so like, well, also you could also like branch out into vaginas and do a bargain bucket.
This started as such a nice podcast all about cakes.
And now we're talking about whale vagina.
It's always about whale vagina on this show.
But I decided for mine, I looked at restaurants that take pride in their bad service.
Okay.
So in the United States, there's obviously in the United States, so there's quite a famous one called Dick's Last Resort.
Wait, was that not the last restaurant?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like American cinema. Something goes very well in the Far East and then they adapt it for the American market.
There we go.
Opened in Dallas, and the original owner, Dick Chase...
so
get out of your system. Get out of your system. He wanted to open a fine dining establishment, but it was a total failure and resulted in bankruptcy. And rather than continue trying to go upscale, he decided to, in his own words, go sloppy. And his yes, Dick Chase went sloppy. The service would be awful. There would be souvenirs like T-shirts that said things like "I love dicks" and "Real women loves dick."
Wow.
That you would be given an adult bib and large handmade paper hats to wear during the stay. There'd be no napkins, and if there were napkins, they'd be thrown at the customers, and you'd be abused by the staff, and everyone would be really obnoxious. But it was all part of the experience. Let me tell you about my choice, and it is the Sam Woe restaurant on Washington Street in San Francisco's Chinatown, which was reputed to have have the worst waiter in the world, a chap called Edsel Ford Fong. And he was an awful, awful man, and people seemed to enjoy it a lot. So when people got to the restaurant, they would walk past steaming woks and chopping blocks. He'd be greeting, he would greet patrons with the words, "Sit down and shut up."
I mean, we've all worked in service at some point. Yeah. We've all been there.
According to one diner, he made the soup Nazi from Seinfeld look like the Dalai Lama. and it was like a cultural hotspot in San Francisco. There would be celebrities and gamblers, musicians, beatniks, hippies mingling with Chinese immigrants there.
Plus, this is in the 60s.
Yeah. It was 60s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
And it's been open for almost 100 years now. On the table, there would be the house rules spelling out no booze, no jive, no coffee, milk, soft drinks, or fortune cookies. he was
the prohibition era in America would have been wildly different if it was fortune cookies instead of alcohol.
He was quite an imposing figure with a very sort of like a military haircut. He would talk lovingly about Chiang Kai-shek, who was the Chinese leader who preceded Mao Zedong. And let me just read you about some of the experiences people had there. If there was a line and you weren't a regular, even if you were at the head of it, you had to wait. If you asked questions about the food, Edsel would point to the menus tacked to the wall, all in Chinese. He would slide your bowl across the table, not minding if some of it messed your pants or shirt along the way. He'd throw the chopsticks on your table like they were a pair of dice, and to make matters worse, he'd laugh about it right in your face. someone once tried to order a Diet Coke and he was responded by going, "You stupid, no Coke, tea only, no sweet and sour. You see on menu, you get house special chow fung, no fork, chopstick only. What you want, fat man?" another customer once tried to order fried shrimp and Edsel yelled at him, "No, it's a rip-off."
Wow.
If you took too long reading the menu, then Edsel would reply going, "What is this, a library?" You won't by the end. If you had spent too long there eating too long, he would come over, bop you on the head with a spoon, and then try and literally broom you out there. Only one diner, who bought him a weekly ration of free X-rated movie passes, was permitted to enjoy a post-meal cup of Edsel specialty, which is apparently just some ginseng.
You got to pay in porn if you want to get the cheese board.
sometimes, when first time customers came along, he would say to them, "You want to sit and eat? You clean the plates from the table." So people came up, they spent 15 minutes clearing the table and then doing their own washing up in the kitchen before they had to go and sit down.
Tidying up the previous lots.
Yes.
Wow.
When they wanted to order, he would then throw his notebook on the table and go, "Right, well, you write down what you want." And then at the end, when they had to do the bill, he would say, "Add it up yourself." And then the crew came in the kitchen, Edsel ordered him to get up and deliver it himself. And at the very end of the meal, he would say, "Small check, big tip. And if you left anything less than 20%, you'd be verbally hounded out of there." So this is all sort of weirdly charming.
It's the sort of place that if you had relatives you didn't like staying in the city, you go, "I know this really lovely little Chinese place."
But, because remember, this was the 60s and 70s, he was a bit gropey as well.
He
would take photos of him with all of the female clientele.
He was nicer to them, though?
Well, would you rather be verbally abused or groped by a middle-aged Chinese man? and it was, how can I put it? It was 70s Mad Men groping. So, not the worst you can do, but very less than ideal.
Yeah.
Patting bums and saying, "Give me a kiss," and saying he didn't understand because he was Chinese, so there was a different culture going on. And he would make sure there was a wall dedicated to all the pictures of him with all the beautiful women. So that takes the shine off the otherwise charming, terrible service. But because, and I've no idea whether the food was any good or not to the same extent, but similar to Emperor Norton, he kind of became like a locally famous.
Essentially, yeah, we did an episode about the world's worst monarch, and Emperor Norton was basically a homeless guy in the 1860s who declared himself Emperor of the United States in San Francisco, and the members of the public sort of went along with it. And by the time he died, 30,000 people came to his funeral, which is lovely.
Yeah, I don't know how many people came along to his funeral, but
I hope they said when he died, "Do your funeral yourself."
he He was a regularly recurring character in Armistead Maupin's series Tales of the City, which is a bunch of novels.
Oh, yeah.
He had a cameo in the 1981 Chuck Norris film, An Eye for an Eye. And Robin Williams referred to him in his eulogy of Herb Kahn, don't know who that is. Yeah. He's also memorialised by a portrait on Gold Mountain, which is a mural depicting Chinese contributions to American history. So, yeah, quite a figure.
Yeah.
But because of Ed Selford Fong himself, I'm going to say that Sam Woe's restaurant in San Francisco's Chinatown is my selection for the world's worst restaurant.
He's going to be a guest on the show.
Our selections for world's worst restaurant are Barry's cholesterol-busting choice of the Heart Attack Grill, David's own self-inflicted trip to the Ivory Worms in the Ivory Coast, and mine of a maitre d' whose customer service makes Piers Morgan look like a warm and genial host at Samwise restaurant. David, some lovely stories, and I like the fact that you sacrificed yourself for this, but you can't remember the name of the establishment, and I don't want to tarnish all of the Ivory Coast culinary scene.
That's true.
With that brush. And also, you brought it on yourself, mate. So the choice between you and me, Barry, is whether it's, is it the bad service or the
murderous food?
Is the food good at yours, though?
I mean, apparently it's fine, but it's also extraordinarily unhealthy.
Yeah, it's
not just eating in a burger restaurant. It's eating in a burger restaurant that deliberately is provoking your heart attack.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about Americans' approach to food that makes me very angry.
Yeah.
It's interesting that both of these are in America.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Is it the food being provoked or your emotions? I'm going to say, because we all quite liked Ed Selfong, apart from the gropey bit.
Yeah.
We were like, mine is a little bit like performative art.
Yeah.
I would go there.
Yeah,
to be groped probably as well.
He was playing the character of Ed Selfong.
Yeah, more like Lorraine Kelly.
Yeah.
So, because of that, and because I hate a burger that's too big.
Yeah.
Like, the place where I do a quiz, like, really, really great food, but the burgers used to be the size of your head, and they fall to bits, and he's just changed it, so it is the perfect stuffed burger.
Yeah.
Whereas yours is, like, man Eight versus patties. Food.
Yeah.
Also, I don't like leaving food, so I would be forced to sit there and eat.
And oh, and yeah,
9,000 calories.
Yeah, and if you don't eat the food, you get spanked, don't forget. So
spanked by Ed Selfong in a special guest appearance. So I'm going to choose yours, Barry, so the Heart Attack Grill.
Yay.
Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. And we stay in the United Kingdom, where Aviva have had to apologise after emailing thousands of customers and mistakenly calling them all Michael. we've all hit a reply all, but they basically, according to a temporary technical error, used the same mailing template for thousands of people.
Which is great for a company that manages your insurance.
Yeah, it's a bit of a worry, isn't it? Just for context, there were 869 babies named Michael in England and Wales in 2018, making it the 74th most popular name, so they'll have got a lot just by chance anyway. Before we go our separate ways, David, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Not what we were discussing before. You can find me on social media, Nomad Baker David, across my platforms. I'm not very good at it. And then, The Guardian. So I write a column in The Guardian. And then if you just go for a run around where I live, you might see me running around as well.
But try and catch them, that's the next trick.
Yeah, oh, glorious, okay. Well, that would be a nice little Worst Foot Forward outing where we'll conga line through Richmond Park and catch you up.
Yeah, we could add you to the Worst Foot Forward scavenger hunt.
Yeah.
If you can find David Atherton.
We're all off to Buxton, followed by Evian, to introduce David to the concept of bottled water. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.